This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The Obama administration is increasing the numbers of Syrian refugees who will be allowed to enter the country as they flee that country's brutal and long civil war. It's just the latest global crisis that has forced millions to leave their home countries. In recent years, that includes many refugees from Sudan and Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. But what is a refugee? What are the laws and rules surrounding their resettlement in the U.S.? Once they get here, how do they adapt to their new homeland? Today, Where We Live, refugees in Connecticut, you can join the conversation at 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We'd like to hear your stories as well. If you or someone you know or love has fled to the U.S. because of war or persecution, we'd like to hear your stories. Again, you can give us a call or find us on Facebook or Twitter at Where We Live. I want to bring in first Chris George, who's executive director of IRIS. It's Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. And this is an organization that we've spoken with in the past on Where We Live and on WNPR. And Chris, I welcome you into our studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
First of all, maybe you can answer the question that I posed to our listeners in the introduction, which is, what exactly is a refugee? Can you describe exactly what a refugee is that's separate, different from, say, someone who comes in seeking some sort of life here that we would refer to as an immigrant?
Right. Well, refugees are immigrants, but they're a kind of subcategory of immigrants. What makes them different is that they have fled persecution. Persecution because of their race, their religion, their nationality, their political opinion, or their social group. And if they have a well-founded fear of persecution or they've actually been persecuted and are forced to leave their home country, go to another country, they're given refugee status by the United Nations.
How does one prove this persecution? I can only imagine that that's not an easy task, or maybe it's easier than I know.
Well, before they're selected and invited to come to the United States, there's a fairly rigorous interview process that the U.S. government puts refugees through. They first determine that they really are refugees. They have to prove that they have a well-founded fear of persecution. You know, what do you mean you were threatened? Describe the threat. You know, what do you mean your son was kidnapped? When did it happen? What was his name? Under what circumstances? So there's a tough interview. There's a background check also conducted to make sure that no one is connected to a terrorist organization or is involved in any terrorist activities. There's also a health screening. And then after all of that, the U.S. government will invite about 70,000 refugees from all over the world to come to the United States and to start new lives.
When you say the U.S. government will invite 70,000 people to come to the U.S. and start new lives, where are people right now in 2014 coming from mostly?
Across the United States, there are about 350 refugee resettlement agencies that resettle the 70,000. And the top nationalities are Burma or Burmese, Bhutanese, Iraqis, Congolese, Afghanis. We also resettle Cubans, Colombians. In New Haven, where IRIS works, the top nationalities that we resettle are from Afghanistan and Iraq, Congolese and also Sudanese.
Afghanistan and Iraq, I can only assume that those numbers have increased over the course of the last decade plus that the U.S. has been ongoing in conflict there, and those wars have forced people out of that country.
Yeah, in fact, some of the refugees that we've resettled, many of the refugees we've resettled from Iraq and Afghanistan are people who worked with U.S. forces in those countries. They were interpreters. They drove trucks. They worked on U.S. bases. And because of that, their lives were threatened. They're considered traitors by the terrorist organizations who have gone after them. Many of them have been killed. Their family members have been kidnapped. They're fortunate to have fled with their lives. And then they're selected to come to the United States.
What is it about New Haven that specifically might have you bring in individuals from some countries versus other countries? I mean, why would you have more refugees coming to New Haven from, say, Iraq and Afghanistan than some of the other countries that you mentioned earlier?
Well, the State Department wants to make sure that a refugee resettlement agency has the language capabilities to resettle a nationality. We did have people on staff who spoke Arabic. This was 6-7 years ago when Iraqis first started coming. And then some nationalities, some refugees won't stay in a place if they don't have other community members, other people from their country in that city. So there's a growing community of Iraqis and Afghanis in the New Haven area. We also have a successful employment program, so people are getting jobs, and my colleague Will talk about that. And when people arrive in New Haven, they generally stay. It's a great place to resettle refugees. Connecticut, in general, despite the reputation we might have in this state, is really a very welcoming place for refugees.
We're talking today with Chris George. He's executive director of IRIS. It's the Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. It's an organization that helps refugees resettle here in Connecticut. We're talking about this issue nationally and locally, and we're going to be hearing some stories throughout the course of the day as well. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. If you have come to the U.S. as a refugee yourself, we'd love to hear your story. I want to turn to someone who's come into our studios. Farha Mohammed is a former journalist and refugee from Sudan and Eritrea, who's now a client of IRIS and living here in the state. Farha, welcome to our show. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Could you, first of all, just maybe tell me a bit of your story? What brought you to the United States?
I was living in Eritrea, but because I was at the military service, and it was not safe for me, so I moved with my husband to Sudan. And in Sudan, my husband, he's a journalist, and he was writing his opinion about the government, the political, all that stuff in Sudan. And that's make problem to me and to my kids because he moved to another country at that time, and that's make the government of Sudan angry and mad. So the
government of Sudan is angry at your husband for what he's writing politically as a journalist.
Yeah, and he write and he move. I mean, he didn't stay in Sudan. So they was thinking if they kidnap my son, the dad, he will come back. So what they was trying to kidnap my son several times. They was going to his school, and they came to my apartment several times and broken the door, doing a lot of scary stuff. So at that time, I can't return back to my country because I will use the airport and it will not be safe. So I went to the UNICEF and I explained to them, and I went to the UNHCR to explain my problem. I don't feel safe. They tried to kidnap my son. I was very lucky at that time because the process of the interview, all that stuff getting fast in two months. So I get phone call on Monday and they ask me, do you want to go to America? After 2 days, and I say, okay, because I was just worried about my kids.
Sure.
So it's take just 2 days to come in here.
Really? And did your husband come with you?
At that time, no.
Yeah.
No.
So is your whole family together now? Is your husband with you now?
He's coming here, yes, 4 months ago, yes.
Yeah. So talk about that time as we talk about the various things that might lead someone to leave where they're from. You talk about a very scary situation that has to do with your husband being a journalist. Aside from that instance that you had in your family, were many others in your country, did people feel unsafe? Were there others who were seeking refugee status at the same time?
Yes, yes. I mean, there's even my brothers, he was a refugee for a couple years in Europe because he was living in Eritrea, and like I said, the military service, if they take you to the military service, you will serve for your own life. I mean, I was serving for 5 years. I have friends. She served 13 years, and they put you in the war, and, I mean, you cannot contact your family, so that's scary, I mean, for everybody to go to the military service.
And you're a journalist yourself.
Yes.
To tell me a bit about your career there. I know that you worked in radio.
Yeah, I was working in mass media in Ministry of Information in Eritrea. And I had my own program they call it, with the youth. I mean, I was doing the interview, going to the airport, going to the street with the mic, and I get phone calls, and I was also, I was trying to contact the people with their family. I mean, there was a lot of people in Europe, a lot of country, they don't know how to contact with their family in Eritrea. So they just call in the program and say, my name, this and that, and I want to greet my family. I'm fine, my name. And they mention a lot of stuff, like say, I'm happy and I want to contact with my family. And
That's quite a service you were providing, huh? The people calling in just to be able to send a message to their families. That's quite a service.
Yes, and also I have the part of... I mean, I had show, it was in Arabic, and I was reading to the, the interesting books, how to know about America, a lot of country, I mean, and I was also bringing people from different places to tell the story about how do you find your country, and I was happy to do that program at that time.
Are you happy now that you've left? I understand that after you left, government agents were still seeking you. They burned your house down?
Yes, in Sudan. Yes, I get phone calls from my friend. Sorry, she said we was worried they burn you and your kids. But one of the neighbors, they said we saw you going to the UN car, so that means you're safe.
Yeah, my goodness. So you must be relieved that you've escaped. How has the transition been?
When I was there, the most important thing to me at that time, it's my kid's safety. Yeah. Doesn't matter where I will go. And like I said, I didn't have any choice to choose where I will go. Just I was looking for a safe place. And honestly, the idea to come in here, it was just scary for me, but it will not be the same scary or the weird, like the safety in that time.
We're talking with journalist Farhal Mohammed, who is a client of IRIS. That's a refugee resettlement organization here in Connecticut. We're going to take some of your phone calls in just a moment. Before we take a break and talk about some of the things that IRIS offers people like Farhal who are coming here, I just want to ask Chris George briefly to talk about how typical or common maybe Farhal's story is, or maybe how it differs from some of the other stories that you hear.
Well, the amazing thing about refugees is that they come from all walks of life. I mean, we will welcome farmers. We'll welcome people who are not literate in their own native language. And we'll also welcome people who are accomplished businessmen and women, journalists, doctors, engineers. They come from all walks of life. And it's, what they have in common is that they had to flee their home country because of persecution. They're expected to hit the ground running. This is a tough, demanding program, refugee resettlement. They don't have a lot of time to acclimate, to do job training, or even to learn English. They're expected to become self-sufficient by about the sixth month that they're here. Some will get jobs immediately. Some will take a bit longer.
What happens if they're not self-sufficient?
Well, then it's a problem. They will have to find a cheaper place to live. They might have to double up with someone else in another apartment. IRIS will have to look around for private funding to help support them a bit longer. I mean, we're talking perhaps maybe a single mom with five kids, maybe two of them have health problems. I mean, these people will need a little more time to become self-sufficient. But there are supports and organizations out there in Connecticut that step forward and help out. We've got great partners. We have amazing donors who have helped us. This is a public-private partnership. We get a little bit of funding from the federal government to get things rolling, and then we need to supplement it with private funding.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to meet Will Kinnearum, who's the Director of Employment and Education Services at IRIS. We're going to talk more about the stories of refugee resettlement here in Connecticut. And you can join us, 860-275-7266. If you have thoughts of your own or questions, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, we're talking with the group IRIS about refugee resettlement in Connecticut. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. I want to bring in Will Kinnearum, who's Director of Employment and Education Services at IRIS. Thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here, John.
I'm wondering if you can just sort of weigh in on the question that I asked to Chris George just a moment ago about Farha's story and whether or not this is something that is a typical story or whether or not the story that she has, it differs quite a bit from others that you see.
Well, I would have to agree with Chris in that the stories are so varied that we come in contact with at IRIS that, sure, it seems unusual, but 8 out of 10 stories are unusual. When Farha first came, she brought special capabilities. She speaks Tigrinya, the language of Eritrea, as well as Arabic and, of course, English. So she was a wonderful interpreter and translator for us, as well as for our program at Yale New Haven Hospital, a great partner we have in New Haven. And so Farha is special and unusual, and I'm always amazed by how many of our clients fit those categories.
Tell us a little bit about some of the big challenges that people face that you have to help folks overcome.
We know how tough the economy is right now. So many Americans are dealing with foreclosures and bankruptcies. And imagine coming with a suitcase and less than perfect English, perhaps, very often no English at all, and no network, no contacts in the U.S. It's an enormous challenge when you're faced with a few months of assistance, realizing that to hold on to your apartment where rents are high, shockingly high to most people who are coming from where our populations come from, Africa and the Middle East, it's a daunting task. On top of which, the economy is such now that it's often only possible to start with a part-time job. So we have many people, like Farha, who have impressive backgrounds, have worked in demanding jobs, have terrific educational backgrounds, and they're forced to look at minimum wage plus labor, and often, as I mentioned, part-time.
So tell us about the training that you offer. I mean, what is it that you do to help people who come with this set of circumstances that you're talking about?
We have a full list of services. When refugees first arrive in New Haven, case management takes them under their wing, and they help people get the IDs that they need, Social Security cards, employment authorization cards. After a year, people are eligible to get a green card, a permanent resident card. And we have a wonderful education coordinator who makes sure that the refugee children are getting into the schools locally and that the parents understand what a parent-teacher conference is. Health and wellness is such a big part of the picture. Our health and wellness coordinator is making sure that everyone has a refugee health assessment within a month. Within 10 days of arrival, we in employment meet with refugees, and we first do an employment assessment, which takes approximately an hour, and we get to know our clients and use that to build a resume. And we give them the hard truth, which is you're going to need to find work within 3 to 6 months. And the process needs to begin now. So it can be difficult for a chemical engineer to think about a part-time job at Walmart. But like so many immigrants that have come to this country over a couple of hundred years, people do understand that this is an opportunity. And with it, they have the kind of safety and freedom they did not previously. And they're often working for a future, not for a present, and for their children. So we see the kind of dedication which I don't think we always see when people take on minimum wage plus jobs.
Mm. I want to get a call here. Alex is in Meriden. Hi, Alex. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to commend the work that IRIS does. I have been working with a ministry. It's called Unity House Collaborative Ministry. And we have hosted over 10 refugees and currently we have a single mother with her son. They're from the Congo, and IRIS has been amazing in helping us do what we feel called to do as people of faith. And I just want to give a shout out and appreciate all the work that they do, and ask folks in Connecticut to really do support work that they do, because it's really amazing.
Alex, thank you very much for your phone call. Chris George, how many organizations like this do you work with? I mean, can you give us a little sense of how you work with other organizations that want to place people, that want to train people, that want to help your cause?
Right. Well, there's a lot to do when refugees arrive. We usually get about a two-week notice. We have to set up an apartment. We need donated furniture for that apartment. We've got to stock the kitchen with food. We've got to find someone who can cook a culturally appropriate hot meal to serve the refugees when they arrive. The services that we'll describe, sure, we can do those by ourselves. And I have an amazing staff, dedicated, talented, incredible people. But we resettle 230 refugees a year. Mm. We need help. And we have a volunteer program that helps bring in hundreds of volunteers every year. We partner with local organizations, churches, synagogues, mosques, Rotary clubs. There are a lot of opportunities for local groups to get involved in helping refugees.
Farha, I'd like to ask you a little bit more about your transition to the United States, because you told me in no uncertain terms that what you were facing was very scary, but what you were fleeing was scarier. And I think that that's quite clear. But tell us about some of the fears and some of the issues that you really had to grapple with, the things that weren't immediately easy when you came to the United States and with all the things we've just heard, that you have to make a life for yourself now. What were the hardest things?
Before I came here, I was asking people when I go to America, I mean, when I get the phone call on Monday, how would the life over there? But I think I asked the wrong people, because they said they will put you at the camp when you go to America. But I keep asking them, is that safe? They say yes. And when I came here, at the airport, my kids' manager, she was over there, her name Linda, and she hugged me, and I was surprised of that. And again, she showed me the apartment that I will live over there with my kids. I have two kids, and I was surprised again. I say, I will live here by myself. And really, because when I was there, and just two days just to be here, I didn't bring anything. I just bring a couple, some clothes, and that's it. No money, no anything. So when I come in here and I met, I contact with Iris, or they was helping me with a lot of stuff. And my son, he's asthmatic. He was sick. That the most worry about to come in here without money. But immediately he have appointment to go into the Yale New Haven Hospital. And it was free. It surprised me. And after that, I started working. I started working Iris like a voluntary. I mean, and after that, Chris, he hired me, and I was working there part time. And my kid, they start to go to school. And at that time, I said, I can't do it. I can't live here.
Yeah. How are your kids doing? How have they managed this transition? Because it must be a big change for them.
At the beginning, like I said, because they was scared my son and tried to kidnap him, and he can understand that. I think he was 5 years old, and he know that there is dangerous over there. But when we come in here, yes, it take a time until he feel or be sure that he will be safe. Now my son, he speak English. Even my daughter, they don't speak Arabic. They love this country, and they feel safe. I leave them at school. I was worried to leave them at school when I was in Sudan. But sure. Now they spend good time at the school. They learn a lot of good things at school. I'm so happy about that.
I'm wondering, Will, if you can maybe talk a little bit more about the services for kids, because I think education is obviously something that's incredibly important, not just to teach them English, but to make them feel as though they're part of a community and ready to learn. To talk a little bit about the educational services.
So true. Well, first, I want to quickly mention our ESOL program for adults. That is such a key component to hitting the ground running in the U.S. And we have two English language teachers who handle three different levels of English. And that's often a place where communities are being built. People get to know each other, and they're learning about the employment process as well. When parents see their children thriving in a different situation, I think that goes a long way toward making them feel more comfortable in their new home. And so when we have adults in our ESOL classes, often their young kids and toddlers are across the hallway in a daycare situation. And so already they're learning to trust different situations and see that these kids are building friendships with other children from all over the world. And that makes the transition to perhaps a daycare situation that is offsite and very much needed in order for people to handle an employment situation is more palatable. The schools in New Haven are wonderfully receptive to refugee children. And we have a great program at the Fairhaven School, where we also have an after-school program. So that process, of course, is comforting and so quick. Children learn English in no time. So I think often after 3 to 6 months, they're beginning to teach their parents words. And that's a big part of what makes the transition easier to handle.
Our producer, Josh Nalea, spent some time with you, Will, at IRIS, listening into some of the classes that you offer there. Let's listen to a little bit.
So I'm here in New Haven at IRIS with Will Knierim. Will, can you tell me a little bit about what's going on here today?
Absolutely. We're in the main hallway here at IRIS, where often clients gather waiting for a class to begin or to get out. Off this hallway, we have a beginning English class that's currently going on with about 8 or 10 students. Across the hallway, we have a higher level English class, which at the moment is all women. We also have childcare going on, so it's a busy, interesting, often loud scene here at IRIS.
Excellent. Do you think we might be able to take a listen to some of these classes?
Absolutely. Well, let's go into the level one English class.
Okay, now this one, Birte.
I am a chef.
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 Chef. What's a chef?
The cooking.
Cooks.
Cooks.
That's right.
I'm a chef and he's a doctor.
Okay.
I live in New York. He lives in San Diego.
Okay. Now, your turn.
We have some money, so let's hear some counting. Sadie is our best student, so she can do it first very, very fast, yes?
220, 240, 260.
260 plus 8, yes, 280, very beautiful. Malika, how much do you have?
There's some noise in here you might want. The childcare room.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Come on, you guys. Show off your English.
Hi.
That's very good.
We have childcare so parents can go to.
Yeah, that's great.
Masaji, let's do ABC for him. You want to? Here, watch. Ready?
Oh, you speak Arabic.
Say ABC into in here.
A, B, C, D, E, L, D.
And those are some sounds that Josh Nell had gathered from Myers. That's great. Who are we listening to? Do you know?
Yes, we're listening to a child who is from the Sudan, and we're actually the level one English class is being taught by a Ukrainian immigrant to a number of people that cover 3 continents and 6 countries. So that just gives you a taste of why it's such an exciting and rewarding place to work.
My goodness, it really, that's quite something, Chris. And the Ukrainian immigrant teaching English to people from Sudan and other places. And I can only imagine that you run across some pretty amazing stories and that you probably learn a little something about people and life and resiliency every day with this group.
I love the job. It's best job I've ever had. I've done it for 9 years. It's probably also the hardest job I've ever had. And I've worked in a lot of places, but they're amazing people, and it's like a low budget United Nations. Our office. There's a lot of things going on. People come from unfortunately horrible circumstances. Some of the children have seen some things that we would never ever want our children to see or witness. They are incredibly resilient, but they also need some help along the way, because on top of that trauma, they've got to learn a language, they've got to find a job, they're under pressure to make money and pay the bills. So it's a lot that's asked of refugees. We don't have a ton of money for this program, Before you know it, these kids are winning academic awards in their schools. The parents are getting jobs. I mean, for us, when someone gets a job, it's a reason for celebration. We will often ring a bell and gather everybody around in the office and applaud the person. I mean, it is not just an income, but it is a boost to their self-esteem.
I'd like to ask you about something that's obviously kind of on the minds of a lot of people in America right now, and it has to do with immigration and U.S. immigration policy. And I'm wondering if you can maybe put this in a little bit of context for us, because I think that for many people, there's probably a very bright line between someone who seeks a better life in this country and someone who is fleeing something like Farha was, you know, you're literally fearing for your children's life. That said, I think in many cases, there are probably millions of people who are trying to get to the United States for whom that line is much less bright, where they might not be able to claim or prove the type of political or other persecution that one might require to be a refugee. You truly are trying to escape some pretty bad situations. I mean, we think of the young people showing up from Central America and fleeing war at the southern border. I guess I'm wondering if you, as someone who works with refugees, if you can put a little bit of context for me into that conversation as we look to hopefully come up with some sort of a immigration policy in the United States that works for everyone. We seem to have this really interesting conundrum on our hands with so many people wanting to come here because there are so many places around the world that are frankly so bad that people need to leave and find someplace else.
Right. Well, I think one answer is we need to do both. We need to have a strong refugee resettlement program. Right now we're inviting 70,000 refugees, and these are, again, as I said, people who have fled persecution. We're inviting 70,000 to come in. I think that number should be larger. We also need to have immigration reform. We need to have a program that allows immigrants to come into this country who are not refugees but still want to come here, have something to offer. And yes, they might not be fleeing persecution, but they live in a place with a failing economy, a corrupt government. They can't make enough money to keep their family alive. I mean, the line between persecution and someone in that category is sometimes a little blurred. The unaccompanied kids who came in the thousands over the summer, the estimate is that about half of them will be able to demonstrate that they're fleeing persecution, so they'll be granted refugee status or asylum, as we call it, when it's granted to someone in this country.
And do you have a sense of how many people are awaiting refugee status to enter the United States, like how long the waiting list is?
Well, the estimate is there are about 15 million refugees in the world today. There are probably twice or three times as many internally displaced people. That is, they have fled their homes but not crossed an international border. And the UN estimates that that's probably larger, that number is larger than it has ever been since World War II. So more refugees and displaced people than this world has ever seen since World War II.
Let's let that sink in for a second. That's amazing. I mean,
it is, and the most recent and critical refugee crisis is, of course, the Syrians. There are probably between 2 and 3 million Syrian refugees, 1 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. They've also gone to Turkey and Jordan. The U.S. government has recently announced that we're going to take in, over the next couple of years, about 10,000 Syrians. But our refugee resettlement program moves very slowly. And partly for good reason. We really do need to do thorough background checks and interviews with everyone, face-to-face interviews with everyone who comes in. But we probably won't be seeing large numbers of Syrians in this country until next year.
And that's despite the fact that it will maybe 2 or 3 million refugees who've crossed international borders, but we talk about internally displaced people. I mean, there could be approaching 10 million people in Syria who are not at their home anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, the numbers do put a perspective on things. The 120,000 refugees that are resettled globally every year represent less than 1% of the refugees, the 15 million number that Chris just mentioned. And America takes in more than half of that number. It's something we're proud of. we're number three in the list in terms of countries that resettle refugees per capita. While Australia and Canada have smaller populations, they do take in many refugees as well. We think that number should be increased. And yes, it is a logistical issue, but the problem grows. So we'd like to work harder to manage it.
We're talking with Will Kinnearum and Chris George of IRIS. Farha Mohammed also works with IRIS. She's a former journalist and refugee from Sudan and Eritrea who's living here in Connecticut now. We're going to take some more of your phone calls when we come back at 860-275-7266. And we're also going to hear from a young reporter that we're working with, someone who's been on the program before, to tell her story about being a refugee and coming to live in Hartford. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. I'll be joined, as always, by our own Colin McEnroe, and we'll have a panel of reporters and political analysts to catch you up on the week's news, including some big shakeups at two Connecticut corporations. Hope you can join the conversation coming up on the next Where We Live. We're talking today with the folks from IRIS. It's the Integrated Refugee and Immigration Services. It's one of a few refugee resettlement organizations in Connecticut. And we're hearing the stories of refugees today. Our executive producer, Katie Talarski, has been working with students from Hartford's Journalism and Media Academy. One of those students was born in a refugee camp in Nepal. Her name is Bishnu Katawada. We've heard her on the program before. She was actually one of the students who was asking questions of her superintendent of schools. Her family was kicked out of neighboring Bhutan, and 4 years ago they resettled in Hartford. When Bishnu came here, she spoke no English. She's now preparing for college. Here is Bishnu reading an excerpt from her college essay.
I was born to a world of bamboo huts, food rations, and dirt roads. My family was in a refugee camp in Nepal. We were floating there in a kind of limbo, unsure of who we were and what our future held. We belonged to no country. Kicked out of Bhutan and living in the confines of Nepal's camp. There were few jobs, poor opportunity for schooling, and even food was sometimes scarce. Our family of six shared a cramped living space with little privacy from neighbors. I often cried, fearing that my life would never change. In 2010, that change came when I moved to the United States with my family. I soon realized that this promised land was also a land of struggle, the biggest one being the language barrier. Growing up in Nepal, I only learned how to speak Nepali, so the English language was brand new to me. I began to use my own style of sign language to communicate with teachers and students. I remember asking a teacher if I could go to the toilet when my teacher gave me a pass for the lavatory. I did not realize that these were the same thing. I was confused, too embarrassed to ask again. Instead, I waited until I got home from school to use the lavatory. Language was not the only barrier to overcome. I soon learned what it was to be bullied for being different. Despite being from Nepal, I was called a nasty Indian, as if all Indians belonged to same lesser, gross racial group. When I began to learn English, they bullied me because of my accent. They would laugh, humiliating me and making it difficult to practice my choppy English. I thought that leaving Nepal was the best thing to happen to me, but I did not seem to be turning out that way. I remember telling my father that I wanted to go back to home and that I wished we would never move to the United States. I missed the simplicity of life in Nepal and the way that somehow, despite being without a country, we had made a home. The place that had seemed so hopeless suddenly held a new meaning for me. After some time, I realized that I could not allow my emotions and struggles to dictate my future. Instead, I needed to use them to fuel my determination to progress. I spent hours studying and learning my new language. I wanted to show everyone, including myself, that I was capable of anything. My ability in English grew and I developed confidence in work. Now, as one of the top students in my high school, I can look back knowing what it means to work hard for something you truly want and believe in. Now that I think about college, the future, and new chapter in my life, I'm much more optimistic. I plan to dedicate myself to learning and furthering my education because not many people from my home country have the opportunity to go to college. When I think about those bamboo huts, dirt roads, and sad school, I remember how blessed I am to be where I am today. I think of the responsibility that it's mine to make something of myself and to use the opportunities I have been given to make an impact on others. This is the primary reason that I want to go to college. I know that education is the key to giving my family hope and future, and if I contribute to that, I will work as hard as I can to make this happen.
That's our friend Bishnu Katawada on what her life was like growing up in a refugee camp and then settling in Hartford. She is a senior at Hartford's Journalism and Media Academy Magnet School. She recorded that essay. It's her college essay as part of our multimedia journalism after-school program at CPBN's Learning Lab. This is where we live, and we're hearing the stories of refugees today. Farha, as you were listening to her story, I guess I wanted to get a little bit of your reaction. One of the things she speaks about is this feeling at many times in her life that she misses the things that she had back home. How often do you feel that, and what do you miss back home?
I miss a lot, honestly. I miss my neighbor. I miss my family. I mean, we had to see each other in the morning, or if I didn't show up on the time, they call me, text me. We don't have the same thing here. I miss that thing. I miss to invite people to my home every weekend, but now I can't because sometimes I work. I mean, I don't have weekend off sometimes. And also I miss, when I try to have friend here, I need to explain to them why I'm here, why I'm refugee, what refugee means. Honestly, there's good people and bad people. I met them, but still I'm lucky because I get that much education in my country, or because some of them, I mean, when I start working at the restaurant, they was asking me if I eat fruit before in my country. And also I miss to laugh, to don't worry about tomorrow. But here everything is hard. I need to work to pay my bill. I have kids. I'm single mother still. So all that thing, it's make me worry. And every time I think about my life before, I think about my family, my friend. Mm.
Do you have a large community that you can draw on of people from Eritrea or Sudan who you can get together with here, or is the community small?
The problem is most of the people that I know them, I mean, they work different hours from my hours. I mean, like I say, I work Saturday and Sunday. I feel guilty. I don't spend enough time with my kids. If I want to enjoy to that group, I need to be, I mean, at night with them. I prefer to have a couple hours spend it with my kids. Like I say, my work schedule is becoming crazy. I mean, I don't have the same day offs, but still, time and while, call somebody, say hi, hello, something like that. That's it.
What's remarkable about your story is how American your story sounds, right? You sound like someone who I've interviewed so many people like you who are struggling to find time for their kids and find time for work and find time for their friends and have a life. And obviously, I can tell by your story that you're glad that you were able to escape where you were. But at the same point, do you feel as though this pace of life in America is something that you like? I mean, is it something that you want?
Yeah, there is a lot of things I like it here. I mean, when I was in Sudan or Eritrea, I'm the person number 10. I mean, always the man, he's the number one. They listen to him. Even I fight with men, they believe him. Here, no, everything is different. I mean, people respect me. They respect me because I'm Farhanat. I'm the man, or I'm the rich person. And people judge me because my behavior, not because my color or my religion or I'm refugee. But still, I hope I was telling Will and Chris that we need to have big program time in a while to explain to people about what is the refugee, mm-hmm. what the mean of the refugee, why the refugee coming here. I mean, I have friend, they are coming from village. They are poor. I'm not poor, but it's make me sad here. Some people, they think that I just come in here because I'm poor. I try to explain to them that, no, I come in here because the safety.
Yeah. We just have a few minutes left, and I know that you folks wanted to talk a little bit about a few things that are going on, some events, and also maybe give a shout, Chris, if you would, because I'd mentioned that there are other organizations that do this. IRIS is not the only one in Connecticut.
Yes. In fact, the refugee we just heard speak, she was probably resettled by Catholic Charities in Hartford. They run a refugee resettlement program here. They do great work. And also in Bridgeport, the International Institute does refugee resettlement there. Jewish Federation had historically done a lot of refugee resettlement, but they're another refugee resettlement agency in Connecticut. Farha just reminded me that welcoming refugees really is such a great American tradition. I mean, it's our oldest, most noble tradition. Our poster child is Albert Einstein, our most famous refugee. Our symbol is the Statue of Liberty. And by the way, you know what the pedestal is made of under the Statue of Liberty? Mm. Pink granite from Stony Creek, Connecticut.
There you go. There you go. You have an event coming up that I know benefits this. Could you talk about it briefly?
Yes. Well, I mentioned that we cannot do this alone. We need help. We have incredible donors all over the state, and we have to do fundraising. And our big fundraising event of the year is the Run for Refugees. It's a 5-kilometer a 3-mile run walk through the scenic East Rock Park in New Haven. It happens Super Bowl Sunday morning. So the morning of Super Bowl Sunday, 10 o'clock, you want to do something healthy, you want to come down to New Haven and run or walk in the Run for Refugees. It's February 1st, 2015.
And again, if people want to find more information about it, the best place to go would be where?
Our website or our Facebook page, IRIS.
And what we'll do is we'll make sure that we have that information on our website as well, WNPR.org. Will, a closing thought from you?
Perhaps it's just inspirational to look at people like Farha, someone who, as a journalist, started as a prep cook at a restaurant, Wheeler's Restaurant and Tap Room in Woodbridge near New Haven. Now she's the kitchen manager. She's respected by everybody she works with. Who knows what her future holds? We have so many refugees who've taken myriad jobs and are making an enormous difference in our culture locally and nationally.
Well, Will Kinnearum, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it. I really do.
Thank you, John.
Thanks also to Chris George, who's executive director of IRIS. Thank you, Chris, for coming in and sharing these stories.
Thanks a lot. It's great to have for you to have us here and to give us a chance to talk about this great program.
Oh no, I'm thrilled to, and I also want to thank Farha Mohammed, who is a journalist and who is living here in the United States now. And we want to get you back on the radio. You're very comfortable in front of a microphone. It's good to have you in a radio studio, Farha.
Thank you very much.
It's very, very, very good to meet you. Our program today was produced by Josh Nalea, with Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kion Wolf. The executive producer of our show is Katie Talarski. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. I want to thank our interns, Jackie Filson, Nia Tyler, John Francois, and Colleen Mason. You can continue this conversation on our website, WNPR.org. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.